Two Republicans have now announced their candidacies for the opening in Michigan's 8th District. Rochester Hills Mayor Brian Barnett and former state senator and Senate Majority Leader Mike Bishop say they will be candidates for the opening created by the impending departure of Congressman Mike Rogers. Mayor Barnett, by the way, joins us tomorrow morning here on Current State. There's ongoing speculation over State Senator Joe Hewn of Livingston County and several others in the GOP. No newly declared candidates yet among the Democrats. Of course, Ken Darga, the former state of Michigan demographer, announced his candidacy a few months ago. He visited Current State immediately thereafter. CMU professor Susan Grettenberger is also a declared candidate, also a guest here recently. Speculation on other Democrats appears focused on Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram, who is visiting with Democratic Party officials in Washington, D.C. about a possible candidacy. Clerk Byram told the Free Press's Kathy Gray that, quote, "I really struggle with the divisiveness of Congress and the overall inaction that I've seen. Still, expect a decision by early next week." Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero has left the door open and has asked his Facebook followers what they think. So he's paying attention to that. And all of this says nothing about the 4th District, about the 16th District, and a new senator for the state of Michigan. What a year. To start our program here today, the Annie E. Casey Foundation released its latest Kids Count report yesterday that looks at child well-being across the country. For the first time, its researchers broke down the numbers across ethnic and racial groups and found disparities nationwide when it comes to how our children are faring. And for Michigan's youth, the results were particularly abysmal, especially for African American children, where only two states, Wisconsin and Mississippi, had worse numbers. In Michigan, about 70% of African American children live in high poverty areas, which is the highest in the nation, and nearly 20% above the national average. Here to tell us more about the report and what these numbers mean is Jane Zender Merrill. Jane's the director of Kids Count in Michigan at the Michigan League for Public Policy. Jane, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Mark.
It appears that one of the overall takeaways from this report is that across America, race still plays a very significant role in who succeeds in our society and who doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Despite the fact that we want to believe that all children should have an opportunity to succeed, this report presents pretty compelling evidence that that's not the case.
And the pattern is the same, mm-hmm. state by state, Asian and white kids at the top, African Americans at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What exactly got measured in this survey?
There were 12 indicators that started with low birth weight at birth and went through getting at least an associate's degree in the late 20s. So it sort of goes across developmental stage of education indicators, health, economic well-being. So it's not only outcomes for children, but the conditions in which children live.
Okay. And this was the first study to break down by race and compare across states. What makes that significant?
Well, we know that there are gaps. We talk about the achievement gap here in Michigan, but what we didn't know until this report is how poorly we compare nationwide mm-hmm. with other states. I mean, in New Jersey, for example, African American children are above 500 on the index. We're half that. So, you know, we begin to wonder what are the policies and programs that we could implement here in Michigan that might make a difference, bring us up to more closer to a state like New Jersey.
You looked at this data in a new way this year.
Absolutely.
In other ways, how did it differ from last year's report? Was there something? I mean, do you look at this thing as a year-to-year kind of dynamic?
Well, this is the first year that the National Project has actually brought out a report that compares across states by race, ethnicity.
Okay.
So we've always looked before at averages year by year that the Casey Foundation has been doing for over two decades. And they plan now to bring this report out maybe every 3 to 5 years to look at how we're doing. And it really is helpful to get beneath the state average where we are pretty much at the national average. But when you start breaking it out by race, ethnicity, you see very different patterns, and we can look at it indicator by indicator to see where we're really out of line, for example, with our concentrated poverty.
Is it known why the foundation didn't take this kind of approach before?
I don't know. Okay. I have to say I don't know. I think it's become increasingly clear how much disadvantage is embedded in race ethnicity in this country.
Michigan did not fare well, as we pointed out. What stood out most to you?
I think what stood out most to me was how far below the national average we are for African American children. They are our largest racial ethnic minority. 16% of our children, one of every six. So what happens to these kids has a huge impact on the social and economic viability of this state. And we're in competition with other states to have a well-educated workforce to attract new industries and businesses. This does not bode well for the future of this state if we don't address this issue.
African-American children, I see, were worse off than every state but Wisconsin and Mississippi. 70% of African-American kids in Michigan live in high poverty areas, mm-hmm. which is the highest in the country. That is above the national average by 20%. Those really stand out.
These
numbers ultimately show that conditions are below the national average for all groups of children. Michigan also ranked 34th on the racial index for white children.
That's right.
What's going on there?
I think a lot of it may have to do with the economic downturn in this state. Certainly, we've had over a decade of recession, I would have to say. We haven't really bounced back in terms of employment. There's a lot of growth in the retail sector, restaurants, low-wage jobs. We're not getting high-wage jobs that lead us to families being able to have adequate income for their children. So that's a huge issue. And also in this state, we've pulled back dramatically on safety net programs. We've put in limits on how many weeks you can collect unemployment, how many years you can be on the cash assistance program. We've put in asset limits on food stamps. I mean, we have done a variety of policies that actually are hurting children. Two-thirds of the recipients on the cash assistance program are children. Almost half the recipients of food stamps are children. So by cutting back on these programs, we really jeopardize the potential of our kids.
On a brighter note, I do notice that there were some encouraging data regarding Native American children. What's happening there?
Well, I have to say, I don't think it's so much that Michigan is doing so great, but that other parts of the country, American Indians are really in a bad place in terms of living on reservations where employment is not available. In Michigan, I don't know how much of a part the casinos might be playing in the well-being of Native Americans.
Some economic degree of prosperity because of the casinos.
Right. Actually, for the other three groups that are broken out in this report, Michigan is above the national average. It's our two largest groups, whites and African Americans, that make up close to 90% of our child population, where we're not doing so well compared to other states or the nation.
I'm really curious, when you see these results come in from across the country, do you explore what the states that are doing better are doing? What kinds of things are happening in the states that really mm-hmm. come up near the top and make a comparison?
Right. Absolutely. We'll be looking at what New Jersey is doing, for example. But I think that also our policymakers should be looking at these numbers and thinking, what is it that we're doing or not doing that's either making these statistics worse? What could we do to make them better? We're not having that conversation. We're having a conversation about a multitude of other things, but we certainly are not talking about making sure that all of our kids have an opportunity.
The earned income tax credit often comes up as a problem because that was cut by this state legislature.
Yes.
Is that among other recommendations that you might make? Is the restoration of that?
Absolutely. Yeah. This has been a bipartisan policy that started at the national level. There's a federal earned income tax credit. And it's argued that it's been the best anti-poverty measure in the country. States have been implementing to supplement, and Michigan had a very healthy state earned income tax, which was cut dramatically. It benefits families with children. It lifts families above the poverty level who are not making enough money to meet basic needs. This is absolutely a win-win policy program. It encourages and rewards work. But Michigan has cut our state earned income tax credit. The other area where we've really fallen behind other states really dramatically is in our child care subsidy, which is essential. We need to have access to child care, particularly for low-income families. They don't make enough to afford childcare, which is a hefty expense.
And to what extent is this a topic at the Capitol?
Not so much. It's been one of those programs where we have not adjusted the subsidy amount to recognize quality, to recognize special needs children, and above all, to adjust for inflation.
I take it you're encouraged, though, by the focus on early childhood education.
Absolutely.
That must play a role here.
Absolutely. The $65 million that the legislature passed last year, and again, the governor's promoting another $65 million investment. Unfortunately, they're targeting almost exclusively the four-year-old, the preschool program for four-year-olds, and all the research shows that the best investment is in those early years, 0 to 3, when 85% of the brain architecture is put in place. So that's where you want to target your investments.
It is an election year. We are going to be hearing, we've already heard that the argument that Michigan's economy is on the mend and we will be adding more new jobs. What do you make of that claim?
Well, it doesn't show up in the data around children. The child poverty rate for children, the child poverty rate has leveled out, but it has not gone down. So that has to be a concern. And it's clear also that we're not targeting employment opportunities in minority communities. So access to jobs is critical. Training for jobs is critical. Access to higher education, which is another area where the state is not investing, we really need to look at what we can do to make a broader participation in employment and opportunity.
You want to get these numbers in front of state legislators and the Snyder administration.
For sure.
That a high priority of
high
yours
priority.
At this point?
High priority.
Yeah. We want to thank you for joining us here today. Jane Zender Merrill is the director of the Kids Count in Michigan Project at the Michigan League for Public Policy. Jane, thanks for joining us to discuss this.
Thank you, Mark.
And now it's time for another Current State Public Poetry announcement with contributor Stephanie Glazer.
At the IGA, Franklin, New Hampshire, by Jane Kenyon. This is where I would shop if my husband worked felling trees for the mill, hurting himself badly from time to time, or I would bring my 3 kids, where I would push one basket and pull another because the boxes of diapers and cereal and gallon milk jugs take so much room. I would already have put the clothes in the 2 largest washers next door at the Norge Laundry Village. Done shopping, I'd pile the wet wash in trash bags and take it home to dry on the line. And I would think, hanging out the baby's shirts and sleepers and cranking the pulley away from me, how it would be to change lives with someone, like the woman who came after us in the checkout, thin, with lots of rings on her hands, who looked us over openly. Things would have been different if I hadn't let Bob climb on top of me for 90 seconds in 1979. It was raining lightly in the state park, and so we were alone. The charcoal fire hissed as the first drops fell. In 90 seconds, we made this life, a trailer on a windy hill, dangerous jobs in the woods or night work at the packing plant. Roy, Kimberly, Bobby, too much in the hamper, never enough in the bank. At the IGA, Franklin, New Hampshire, by Jane Kenyon. For Current State, I'm Stephanie Glazier.
If you live in Michigan, you live in the Midwest, right? Well, maybe not. While the U.S. Census Bureau defines the Midwest as a 12-state region between Ohio and North Dakota, many other organizations and individuals have their own definitions. Cartographer Bill Rankin decided to explore the many maps of the Midwest, compiling them all into a single image. The final result included more than the Census Bureau's 12 states. It even included other countries. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Bill, who runs the site Radical Cartography, about trying to map the Midwest.
What did your own personal map of the Midwest look like before you started this project?
Well, before I made this map, I think that my own personal Midwest was a lot smaller. I grew up in Chicago, and so I think I'd always thought of the Midwest as the states that were right around me. So, you know, kind of from Minnesota to Indiana, maybe a little bit of Ohio, down into Missouri, but not much bigger than that. And so making this map, I realized that the Midwest actually not only, you know, should be seen much more expansively, but could actually be seen very, very expansively.
Yeah, I think, like many people like you who live in the Midwest, what they understand the Midwest to be, they're kind of unaware that there are multiple geographical definitions of the region, and that it's kind of even debatable in a lot of cases. So why did you set out to try and map this contested area?
I think probably what provoked it for me was I was looking at, on Wikipedia, there's the map of the Midwest that they have. And if you look at the discussion, it's a very heated discussion. And then what they've ended up doing is just saying, well, we can't resolve this ourselves, so let's use the U.S. Census definition. And I thought, well, this is really interesting. I had no idea this was such a heated topic. So I started collecting maps, not just from the census, but from as many organizations as I could to see just how varied the definitions could be.
What does that census map include as the official Midwest, according to the Census Bureau?
So the U.S. Census includes everything from Ohio on the east to the kind of Great Plains states, the Dakotas, Nebraska, and Kansas, that kind of clump of states there.
All right. So pretty expansive, bigger than your understanding of the Midwest. So, like you said, you decided to look for other maps. What types of organizations or sites hosted these maps of the Midwest?
So yeah, I looked, I used the internet to find really as many as I could. I ended up with about 100. And those came, a lot of them came from different agencies in the US government. So the census has its own definition, but other agencies have very different ones. So, you know, Department of Energy, Department of Labor, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Army Corps of Engineers. But I also looked for maps from other organizations that had some kind of official status, a map that really sort of did something in the organization. So that included lots and lots of different kinds of organizations, everything from the American Chemical Society to the National Model Railroad Association to Home Depot.
Home Depot's Midwest, I like it.
That's right.
So when you made the map, it's essentially, it's outlines of the states that are kind of included in varying shades of pink that get deeper the more times those states are represented in maps. I guess, yeah, describe as best as you can what we visually see when we look at your map, the size and scale of the Midwest.
Sure. So I think there's a shape that pops out, which is the census definition. But then there's a lot of variation within that. Illinois is the darkest state, and then sort of Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa are the next darkest. The Dakotas aren't nearly as dark. And then Kentucky and Oklahoma, Arkansas, Tennessee, they seem like they are actually, you know, more prominent, at least than I would have expected. And you could sort of see Kentucky especially as a kind of, you know, a boundary case. And then there's this vast, vast hinterland, everything from Alberta to Newfoundland in Canada, to Idaho, Texas, Georgia, North Carolina, even New York in one of the maps. So it's a sort of a core region. Illinois is the most Midwest. There's, you know, a handful of states that are clearly Midwest, and then there's lots and lots and lots of options for how big it could be.
What factors contribute or influence what people consider to be part of the Midwest? I mean, why are all these different agencies or definitions using these completely different boundaries?
Well, I think that some of the people are trying to come up with what you might see as a positive definition of the Midwest. So they're defining it based on, you know, kind of the culture of some sort, or, you know, certain kind of immigration in the 19th century, certain kind of soils or watersheds. But I think those are actually not the majority of the maps. Most of the maps, the Midwest is kind of a leftover space. So they'll have a map that says, these are definitely the Western states, this is definitely the South, this is definitely the East Coast, and the Midwest is kind of everything left. So I think that that's how you get some of these very, very big Midwests. But even so, then there are definitely some that do take a positive definition of the Midwest that still include places like Kentucky, Oklahoma, even parts of Texas.
Where there's some maps that include things you're just like, no way is this part of the Midwest.
So Newfoundland was the one that really caught my eye, or Georgia, New Mexico. These seem like real outliers to me. And I think they come across because they have said, you know, we've carved up the country or the continent into the categories that we know. And then the Midwest is kind of the great middle.
What about anything that was left out? Anything that is essentially Midwest that some people just didn't even include in their maps?
Well, what I thought was really interesting was that although Illinois was definitely the most Midwestern state, there's actually no area that everyone agreed upon. So there's some maps that show everything from Illinois kind of west, you know, the few states there. But then there's a map I found that only includes Indiana, Michigan, Iowa, and I think Kentucky, and doesn't include Illinois at all. And so I thought that was really fascinating that even given this huge, vast area that could be covered by the Midwest, there was no area that everyone even agreed on.
What do you think these different definitions or maps of the Midwest say about us?
Well, I think that really drives home the point that we all carry around a different kind of mental geography. That we have this idea of, you know, what our home region is or should be, and we don't even realize that other people can have very different ideas about what it is. And so I think it really speaks to the kind of pliability of the concept and really how much of it is a cultural concept rather than a physical or, you know, biological region.
Does it even matter if we ever agree on a set map?
Well, I think that for me, it was actually what I really gained by making this map was the sense that it's important to hold on to the fact that there isn't a true definition. And I think it'd be a mistake to try to say this is the final map of the Midwest. But rather, I think it's important to see this category of Midwest as pliable, as something that will change depending on where you live or what you think, you know, really matters. And I think it's really important, actually, that there not be a final definitive answer so that we can keep that fluidity alive.
Are you considering doing this with any other regions, looking at how people define them?
Yeah, I definitely thought about that. I mean, I think that even just a quick glance around, I was surprised by how the South, for example, was not as clear-cut as I thought. You know, because there's a definition that comes from the Civil War, but it seems like there's people who have different definitions as well. Another region that I thought about that it was I thought would be a nice complement to the Midwest was actually the Mideast. where there's some agreement about what are the countries that make up the Mideast, but then you find, you know, parts of Central Asia or Northern Africa also included in that.
Bill Rankin is an assistant professor at Yale. He also runs the website radicalcartography.net. Bill, thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot.
For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. General Motors has recalled 2.6 million vehicles for ignition switch failures, failures that are linked to at least 13 deaths. Considering the recent $1.2 billion penalty levied against Toyota for that company's problems related to sudden accelerations, dealing with the ignition switch problem could become very costly to GM. Yesterday, GM's new CEO, Mary Barra, testified before a U.S. House committee.
Whatever mistakes were made in the past, we will not shirk from our responsibilities now or in the future. Today's GM will do the right thing.
Barra will be back today for more testimony, this time before a Senate panel, to learn more about what Mary Barra had to say and what this all means to General Motors. We welcome NPR reporter Sonari Glinton to Current State. Sonari, welcome.
It's good to be with you.
Ms. Barra testified for more than 2 hours yesterday, and the questioning was intense. Could you say the questioning had a particular focus?
Well, the real focus of all of this is, what did GM know and when did it know it? What was interesting about much of Ms. Barra's testimony was that she deferred a lot to a special investigation that's being done with by Anton Valukas, who's a former U.S. attorney. GM hired Mr. Valukas to do the investigation. So that sort of ruffled the feathers a little bit of the congressman, because she wasn't, you know, this is what happened, when, how, et cetera.
So did anything emerge on day one as to what GM knew or when it knew it?
Well, it was clear from documents, interestingly enough, that GM submitted to the committee that it knew about ignition switch problems at least for a decade. And, you know, there are two key points in 2005 when General Motors had meetings about problems. In both times, it sort of said, you know, this isn't cost-effective to do this recall. And Ms. Barra said that the new GM wouldn't act in that way, and that she found those words or that idea that the company chose money over lives to be, you know, not something that that her company would do now.
You're referring to apparently a line in a memo. And the line is quoted on this morning's front page of the Detroit News. None of the solutions represents an acceptable business case. Those apparently coming from an anonymous GM engineer.
And remember, this is the same year that GM was losing $5 to $7 billion. It laid off 30,000 employees and closed 9 plants. You know, so there is an idea that their money was connected somehow to the decision-making process wherever it was happening.
Let's talk about Anton Valukas and the investigation GM is conducting into these faulty ignitions. What more can you tell us about that? Do you think the results of an investigation like this will be accepted by Congress or the public?
Well, you know, Anton Valukas has a tremendous reputation. I'm from Chicago, and I remember he's, you know, considered one of the people who ended the Chicago machine with the Greylord operation. And he casts a long shadow in that world. However, you know, there's some question when a company hires a lawyer to do an investigation, because the company and the lawyer have attorney-client privilege. So, you know, there's this idea that there's a possibility that maybe not all the information will get out there. Congress essentially can only investigate. It doesn't necessarily have the power to act. You know, and that takes, you know, that takes the Justice Department, that takes, you know, the Department of Transportation, which can levy fines. There, you know, this isn't, it's not like that Congress can really do anything. What is interesting is how the public perceives this. You know, 91% of the public says that they understand that there will be recalls. And 87% of the people say that sometimes the information that they get after a recall and the way a company reacts will make them more likely to choose a brand. We're seeing that 77% of GM sales went up by 7%. So while this whole recall mess has been going on, and it would be interesting to see what April sales numbers are. But, you know, in all honesty, this is probably, these 2 days are the most attention that this recall is going to get unless we hear something that isn't in the past, unless we hear something that's last week, last month, last year. You know, this is likely to sort of fade away, and there are going to be results, but I think that the car buying public, you know, has a short memory for these sort of things.
Speaking of public perception, we've been hearing from families who lost loved ones in accidents believed to be linked to this problem with the ignitions. Your report on Morning Edition today included these remarks from Shannon Wooten, whose son Josh was killed shortly after having the ignition fixed in his car.
This right here is like being at the funeral again, you know. If they would have listened to one or two of us, we wouldn't have all these people out here today.
What impact does it have, Sonari, to hear stories from families on Congress and on the public perception of GM?
Well, these are very, you know, tough situations, especially because many of the people who we know to have died in connection with the ignition switch problems were young people, and they were in these small cars. I mean, these are genuine tragedies, but you know, there are a lot of people die in car crashes every single day, and the public understands that. Congress is angry, and people have a right to be angry if it's found out that that GM hid this information. But it is, you know, it essentially, we're going to hear a lot. We're likely to hear more and more stories of people who have been injured or hurt because of, you know, some problem with the GM vehicle, because all of the attention that's been focused on it right now. The important thing for the car company is how it reacts. That's the real thing. And Mary Barra met with some of the victims. You know, there was some mixed, you know, there was a mixed outcome about, you know, what people felt about that meeting. But, you know, it's how the company acts which will determine how those victims feel and how their families feel there's a resolution.
We're talking with NPR Sonari Glinton about day one of Mary Barra's testimony in front of congressional committees. Yesterday, it continues, of course, today. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is also getting scrutinized here for not investigating complaints about these ignition switches. Yesterday, the NHTSA Administrator David Friedman suggested the data that they received from GM in 2007 did not warrant an investigation. Quote, when our team looked at the investigation, there was not a trend that stood out, unquote. How important is that disclosure, Sonari?
Well, you know, in many ways, the way the system works is that that NHTSA has to rely on information from the car maker to determine whether there's a problem. You know, there are, like I said, hundreds of car crashes every day, and there are not that many investigators to go out and look to see what every problem is. And so NHTSA is sort of hampered if the car companies don't fully disclose the information that they have about defects, because they're getting reports from dealers, they're getting reports from customers, et cetera. It's, you know, And the administrator said, the acting administrator said, that, you know, GM hampered investigations by not fully disclosing all the things that it knew and when it knew it.
What about the talk that you hear, Sonari, about the cozy relationship between the company and investigative agencies, oversight agencies?
Well, you know, there's a kind of a revolving door. I mean, you can see it in journalism. You can see it in a lot of places where, you know, people might not be as hard-hitting, say, about General Motors if they want potentially to go get a job there, right? So if you're, you know, if GM and the car companies walk into your office and you're thinking, maybe, you know, my kid's going to college, 2 years down the road, I might want to jump ship and go work for these guys.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's, you know, there's a lot of people who say that there's a perception that there is a coziness. And there's also, you know, after 30 plus years of regulating, there is the sort of people know each other. We're a part of an industry. We talk all the time. And, you know, their criticism is that NHTSA is not a hard taskmaster. That is not a cop on the beat. And, you know, part of that is, you know, some people will say that NHTSA hasn't grown since, you know, the early 80s, and the number of cars and the complexity of cars has, you know, grown tremendously since that time. That, you know, there's been questions about how hampered the agency is, you know, with the terms of tools it can use to, you know, enforce the laws and rules that Congress passes.
As culpable, as neglectful as General Motors appears that it could have been in this situation, there are already stories suggesting the possibility of congressional piling on, of grandstanding senators. Could a really aggressive congressional investigation actually generate some sympathy for the, more sympathy for General Motors in this situation?
Well, I mean, the thing is, there's not a lot of sympathy for General Motors, just in general. You know, in because of the bailout, because of the bankruptcy, because of, you know, a lot of things, there is a steep climb that this company has to make. That said, you know, the Congress is about as focused as the media is, and the next shiny object that comes along, that's where Congress is probably going to look towards. And the same thing is true with the media. And, you know, in 4 months, in 5 months, we're not likely to be paying as close attention as we are right now when Mary Barra is on Capitol Hill and talking to senators. But the thing that the only thing that General Motors can do to create sympathy is to react responsibly to the recall, is to make good cars, is to, you know, those are the things that it has to do in order to get back, you know, any public sympathy. Because as long as there's the perception that General Motors is still that bad company from 2005, that's going to stick around, and it's going to be just this lingering thing. It's not that people are going to be, like, angry at General Motors, but they might see it and then see the Toyota dealership right down the road and go, I'm going to go here.
So NPR reporter Sonari Glinton is covering the congressional hearings into General Motors that began yesterday on Capitol Hill. Sonari, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
It's great to be with you.
It's Wednesday and time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where Current State features people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we feature the Michigan Minority Health Coalition. It's a statewide organization that works to improve the health of Michigan's ethnic and racial minority populations. Here to tell us more is Dr. Ophelia Washington Pryor, the Executive Director of the Michigan Minority Health Coalition. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you for asking me to be with you today.
It's a pleasure. Tell us about your mission at Michigan Minority Health Coalition.
Well, the way we look at the issue is that the country and the composition of the country is really changing. The demographics are changing. Everything points to that. And the statistics that our most current say that by the year 2042, our country is going to be a country where over 50% of the individuals in the country are going to be people of color. And so consequently, I really look at this as the social issue of this century and the next. And the question is, how are we or are we going to learn to live together and with this diversity? So part of our mission is to really work within minority groups to integrate what's going on policy-wise into the major society and also make sure that health equity primarily is achieved for everyone. So we're not an organization that's an exclusive organization. Our organization includes anyone and everyone of all major racial ethnic groups who are really interested in advancing equity for everyone.
And tell us about the formation of your organization.
Well, the organization, we had our first meeting in 2005, and there were a lot of interested individuals in the table, probably about 30 or 40 people that had come out to the meeting. And we had similar ideas and similar views. And one of them was that we wanted to make sure that the United States of America and the state of Michigan was a place where everyone could have opportunities to participate in the society. So one of the issues that we decided on that was really important, there are multiple issues, but the one we decided on was health and health policy issues. And because there are many policies that are made without really looking at the downstream effect of this. And so that's what we looked at. Most of our focus is on health equity. And that's why we've been involved in the Affordable Care Act and letting people know about that.
What particular health challenges have you found in Michigan that people of color face?
The real question is, what issue don't we face? In almost every single disease category, people of color, the rates are worse than those of people who are white. If it's obesity, if it's breast cancer is the only one. African-American women do not have increasing rates of breast cancer, but when African-American women have breast cancer, they die. White women live. If you look at infant mortality, if you look at life expectancy, just run the list. It doesn't matter what we're talking about. Diabetes, kidney dialysis, HIV, in almost every single category, the health outcomes for people of color is worse than people who are white. In fact, our region received grants in the last, from the Kellogg Foundation and one from a national organization on infant mortality, because in our state, the disparity between babies who die that are white and babies who die that are black in the first year of life is 3 times the number. Mm. And so it's like, pick one.
You mentioned being supportive of the Affordable Care Act a minute ago. How encouraged are you by the implementation of Obamacare as far as addressing some of these really profound problems?
Well, the first thing I have to say is, as an organization, to be honest, we were against the way it was initially rolled out. And this was even before there was a law. When people were talking about it, it seemed as if what they were talking about was a different way to pay for insurance. And we know, even though we've heard on the news that we have the best healthcare insurance in the world, that's not true. If you look at the statistics that the World Health Organization uses to decide the health of a country, they use 2 statistics. They use life expectancy of the individuals and in the country, and they use infant mortality. And if you stack all of the countries up, the United States ranks 37th if life expectancy. So 36 different countries live longer than we, people in different countries live longer than we do. And in infant mortality, we're number 30. And the country that's right beneath us is Cuba. We're the United States of America. How can our infant disparity rates be similar to that of Cuba? You know, that just doesn't make sense. So when you hear on the news we have the best healthcare system in the world, that's definitely not true. So the system we have isn't working for white people. It isn't working for people of color. It's not really working. Now, if you look at, we can keep you alive longer with the technology. We have the best technology in the world. That's true. And if you look at cancer treatment rates, we have the best cancer treatment rates in the world, that's true. But if you're looking at overall health, it's not true. So it wasn't working. So when we looked at the Affordable Care Act, it seemed as if they were just looking at a new way to finance what we already have. And there are other organizations that have been saying we needed health care reform for over about 10 years because we spend so much money on health care as a country that it was basically going to bankrupt our system. Our Surgeon General, Kimberly Dawn Wisdom, probably about 8 or 9 years ago, said that if Michigan didn't control the rates of diabetes in our state, it would bankrupt our budget. And so we have realized this isn't working, it's not going to work. But we didn't think initially the Affordable Care Act was going to be a way that this would benefit individuals.
It will improve access.
It will improve now. But I'm saying at first we were saying they're just going to inform the same thing. So now when the law was actually developed and we looked at it, we said, oh, this will help people. This will help everyone. This is close to a colorblind law. It will help everyone. It will actually provide access to people who have been without insurance in the past.
And have you been actively promoting the Affordable Care Act then?
Oh, most definitely. For about the last year and a half, we've been doing outreach and education seminars. Because our organization is targeted on the health of people of color, we've been working in those communities exclusively. Just to give you some idea of the people who are not insured in Michigan, my data is from 2008 to 2010. That's the data that I have from the Michigan Department of Community Health. But 21%, almost 22% of all African Americans do not have health care coverage. 18% of Arab Americans, 15% of Asian Americans, Latinos, 24%, and whites is 15. And so we know that access to health care is important. It won't fix everything, but it's a step in the right direction. So we have been actively promoting this.
What has kept people from signing up, from your experience?
I really think there are two things that are going on. One of them is uncertainty. Well, maybe three. They're not educated as to what this might do. And even there's some fear as well. And so we've been going out, and we've been going into the community, to faith, to places of faith, to charter schools, to anyone really who has invited us to come in, and talking to community-based organizations and explaining to them what this is. It's interesting if you don't. There was a Jimmy Kimmel script, and it's on YouTube. It's really funny. And he goes out in the streets and he says, are you for the Affordable Care Act or are you for Obamacare? Almost everyone is against the Obamacare, but they're for the Affordable Care Act. And they're the same thing.
Yeah.
So that shows how people don't know. It's really funny. And then the other thing, if you just tell people the tenets of it, well, do you think it's right for children to be able to stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26 years old? And people will say yes. And if you say, well, do you think that women should be charged the same rate as men for insurance? People will say yes. But these things didn't happen until the Affordable Care Act came into being.
Our special guest here today is Dr. Othelia Washington Pryor, Executive Director of the Michigan Minority Health Coalition, on our Neighbors in Action segment. The Healthy Michigan Plan just got underway yesterday. What's your sense of that?
The Healthy Michigan Plan it came about because of Medicaid expansion. And as you know, in our state, there were a lot of political wranglings around this if we were going to accept it.
Certainly.
But what happened is that this is different than Medicaid that we have now, because we do have Medicaid in our state right now. But in order to qualify for the old Medicaid, as we like to call it, you had to be a woman with children under 18 in the house. You had to be pregnant or be on SSI or have some disability of some type and low income. And there was also an asset test. You could only have so much money in assets in order to qualify. Well, this is totally different, in that the only thing that's necessary to be provided with the Healthy Michigan Plan, as it's called here, is you have to be low income. That's all. The acid testing is different, and a lot of men, especially men in communities of color, who never were able to receive access to health care because they didn't have children, they weren't in the home, definitely weren't pregnant, now these men are able to receive coverage. And that's important in our communities, and especially because you have men that are coming back into the society from being institutionalized or incarcerated, and now they can have coverage too. We want these people to be well. We want them to be able to participate in the society fully. You can't do that if you're sick.
Where does your funding for the Michigan Minority Health Coalition come from?
Our funding comes from donations. It comes from membership. And surprisingly enough, we've been funded by pharmaceutical companies. They have been a help to us in what we've done. We have some funding. We have received some grants from the state of Michigan. And so that's how we operate. We would love to have more. If you'd like to contribute, get on our website and send us a check. We'd appreciate it.
Do you have volunteer opportunities?
Yes, we do have volunteer opportunities. We have programs that we run. As right now, we've been very involved in outreach and education. So I had trained some individuals to be able to go in their community and other communities to talk about the Affordable Care Act. We give them materials. So there's an opportunity to do that. Right now, the Affordable Care Act the ACA is basically closed unless you have some life-changing situation, but Medicaid expansion is still open. And that's a state of Michigan program that was established through the Affordable Care Act, and that has continuing enrollment. So if people are low income, and I want to give the income because that's important, if you're a family of one, if you have an annual income of around $16,000 or under, or for a family of four, $32,000 and under, then, and you don't have health insurance, you need health insurance, you've lost your job, you have no income right now, or limited income, then you would probably qualify for the Healthy Michigan Plan. And by all means, go in and apply for it, because it's full coverage, hospitalization, lab fees, doctor visits, emergency room visits, it's a full package.
Dr. Othelia Washington Pryor is the Executive Director of the Michigan Minority Health Coalition. She's been our guest today on Current State's Neighbors in Action. Thanks for joining us today. Very informative.
Thank you very much for having me.
Current State could always use more nominations for Neighbors in Action, and we know there are people and organizations out there doing excellent work. We need to find out about them. Please help us out. Tweet us suggestions at KAR Current State, or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the work they do. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with Rochester Hills Mayor Brian Barnett, who is entering the race for Congress in the 8th District. Also, another book review from contributor Scott Southard, that and more Thursday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is Current State's producer. Thanks as well to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery, to Aaron Young for engineering, and Hannah Michael John and Kelsey Block for production assistance. Current State on 90.5 WKAR.